Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. You're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com or CommunityProgressiveRadio.org. Today we have two great guests with two relevant and timely topics. The first topic is about eating poison, food, drugs, and health. And our second topic is about Obama's plan to destroy Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. So stay tuned and we'll be right back with Kalia Ramirez Watson, who's written a book called Eating Poison, Food, Drugs, and Health. So stay tuned and we'll be right back with Kalia. Kalia Ramirez Watson is an independent journalist in the San Francisco Bay Area. She holds a BA in economics from Fordham University and a JD from Indiana University School of Law, Bloomington. In 2011, she was awarded honorable mention in a competition sponsored by the Association of Women in Radio and Television, AWRT, for the radio documentary Do Tell, Queer Women Vets Sound Off About Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Kalia Ramirez Watson, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, first of all, tell us a little bit about yourself and your activism before we get into your book.
Well, I'm an independent journalist, having been with Pacifica Radio's KPFA for about 11 years. Before that, when I was a kid in high school and college, I was a typical Democratic Party activist. I'm now affiliated with the Pirate Party, which is very much related to the pirate parties in the European nations and very much concerned with free speech and intellectual property and copyright and those kinds of things, and they're now branching out.
Why aren't you with KPFA anymore?
Well, I quit when they told me they had to cut back my hours because of their financial problems, and I had only 11 hours and no benefits then. They cut me back to 6, which was not viable for me, yet they had they were giving money to have these various elections.
Right.
And I couldn't see why you cut back the hours of people who actually put things on the air, because I was a reporter and I was a broadcast technician, and give the money to have elections. We know from the outside world that elections aren't exactly the sine qua non of democracy. You can have elections and have a lousy excuse for democracy. And is this a radio station, or is this a graduate seminar in political science? So it was a matter of policy and
right.
priorities.
Well, and as you said, you can have elections and not have democracy, but you can also have democracy without elections. And so many people focus on elections as a sign of democracy or do election protection, when we could actually have true democracy without even having elections.
Yeah, well, the representative democracy that we supposedly have is not the democracy, a direct democracy of, let's say, ancient Greece. And I don't know quite what the answer to those things are, but it's not, we have to democratize, so we have to have these elections, so we have to spend all this money that we don't have on elections. You know, it's putting the cart before the horse.
Well, I think, unfortunately, Pacifica networks all over the country are having these kinds of issues. It's almost like they want to self-destruct or something.
Yeah, I write op-eds for a website called The Leftist Review, and I recently wrote one about the Pacifica Network. And, you know, I think we even have to wonder if Pacifica should survive, because I don't believe as a progressive that corporations should be immortal. And the Pacifica Network was born in 1949. A lot of people born in 1949 died. Does it still have its function? And the way the technologies are going in media, we have other ways of doing things that maybe we don't need a network that was started in 1949 and run like it's still 1949.
Right. So besides all that, and it got a little bit off of our subject, but not really.
No, not really.
Yeah, you published a booklet called Eating Poison, Food, Drugs, and Health. And can you tell me and my listeners about that?
Yes, it's I call it a primer on what the profit motive is doing to our food supply and our health because of all of these big corporations. You have everything from direct-to-consumer advertising of drugs to GMOs to all of the things that are in our foods, the antibiotics that are fed to our meat animals, et cetera. And it is based on a book called Born with a Junk Food Deficiency, How Flax, Quacks, and Hacks Pimp the Public Health. The author of that book is named Martha Rosenberg, and I interviewed her for Women's International News Gathering Service. Unfortunately, Wings only took one of the two interviews I did with her, and I wanted to use this extra material that I got out of the interviews, and also once I transcribed the interviews and added a book review to it, I looked at it and I said, well, gee whiz, what about this, what about that? What makes a good radio interview often leaves things missing for a reader. The reader has more time. Yeah. The reader has more time. So I then filled in with my own research and my own editorial comments, and it's about 30 word processing pages. What your e-reader does will determine the page count on that, but it's 30 word processing pages. It's 99 cents at smashwords.com, and it is a good way for a person who gets very confused about these issues or who is just coming to us for the first time to look around, get an idea of what some of the issues are, and then from there do their own research, because I've added a lot of extra links, and you can follow and along and do your own research, which I think people really have to do today.
Well, what does being born with a junk food deficiency, what is that? You know, I know what it means, but can you? And what the hypothesis is behind that?
Well, that the idea is that the what is wrong with people is that they are missing a certain thing. For example, with the drugs, you have a chemical imbalance. That's one theory that, of course, has been knocked down already, but a lot of advertising is based on that sort of thing. So it's like you are not healthy because you're deficient in something, and of course by saying junk food deficiency you're being tongue-in-cheek about it.
Right.
The book itself actually though talks a lot about the drugs as well as the food. It's a kind of misnomer of that title because really, and the thing that I think is most important is the fact that the drug industry, the pharmaceutical industry, is selling Americans on bad health and potential bad health. And interestingly enough, the only direct-to-consumer advertising in the world is done in two places, the United States and New Zealand. And I'm shocked at New Zealand, really. But we're told you're sick. You've got these symptoms. It may be this, it may be that. Well, you're at risk for this and that. And all Americans can think about is they're sick. So no wonder our health care system is the most expensive in the world. You got a lot of people going to the doctors, the so-called worried well, who don't have anything wrong with them, but they've read something in a newspaper or they've read something on a website, and now they think they've got these symptoms. And then they go and they tell the doctor, I've got this, and now I want this drug, this name brand drug. A lot of times they'll get a coupon that they'll bring to the doctor for prescriptions. And, you know, all we're thinking of is that we're sick, and that's wrong.
Well, I saw a doctor say one time that many GPs believe that women have a Valium deficiency and they have to take Valium for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, and that's a problem that actually goes back for the direct-to-consumer advertising, one of the things that Martha says in her book is that in the 50s and 60s, the professional journals had these advertisements that were terrible. They were very sexist, and they were also very ageist. A woman who wasn't content with the role of housewife and mother had some sort of mental problem, or a woman who had been in menopause had outlived her ovaries and now she was going to be mentally ill and have all sorts of problems and lead to troubles for the husband because she, you know, had outlived her ovaries. And those things actually have carried over now from the private magazines of the profession, the medical profession, into the general public. You know, oh, you take this purple pill and you will suddenly be happy and healthy and you'll dance around in a purple ball gown and you weren't even told what it was for. And then I found out later on that, you know, it was some sort of stomach, you know, you have acid stomach or acid indigestion, take this purple pill, you know. I think the first one I ever heard of was Claritin, and I didn't find out for years until I found out my mother was taking it for sinus. They didn't even tell you what it was for. They said, ask your doctor.
Right.
Maybe I don't have to ask my doctor because I don't have whatever it is supposed to treat. And then, of course, we have these SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and other very powerful mental health drugs mental illness drugs that are being given, for example, to our veterans. They come back horribly ruined by the horrors of war. There's now more suicide cases than there are actual deaths on the battlefield, and they're given these drugs that actually make the matter worse for them. And it's all to make money.
Well, I remember back, I don't know, you probably know, but I remember when it used to be banned letting drug companies do direct-to-consumer marketing. When did that change and why did that change?
It changed in about 1997. So it's actually changed a lot longer ago than I even thought. And it changed because Big Pharma has its fingers in the FDA, and they were trying to tell people, hey, the consumers have to have a choice. They have to know what's out there. And this whole idea of consumer choice is a big mask for the big corporations to do what they want. And so the FDA allowed it. So under certain conditions, there is a link I have in my book, Eating Poison, to an FDA page that tells you what should not be occurring and what you should have in an advertisement. And you should call to complain if things are not as the government has laid out for these companies to advertise, but still they're advertising drugs that you cannot get over the counter. You have to get them from a doctor. And why do you go to a doctor? Because you think there's something wrong with you. Well, you know, there may be something wrong with you, but not necessarily because a commercial told you that.
Excuse me, I don't know what's wrong with my throat today. So I'm 56 years old. Mm-hmm. Many people I know my age and even younger, they like have a bag of pharmaceuticals they have to take every day. I don't take any pharmaceuticals. And
I'm 58. I don't take pharmaceuticals either. And my husband, who's 47, doesn't take them either unless it's an over-the-counter thing he might need for a headache or something like that.
Right. I do take over-the-counter things for headaches or something like that if I have to. But, you know, I try to avoid that. And during allergy season, yeah, I do take some over-the-counter allergy things, but I try to also do holistic things to alleviate the severity of allergies and things like that, or to prevent headaches. However, my question you know, is that even when I was young, back in the 50s and 60s, penicillin was like this wonder drug that cured infections and, you know, things like that. But now these antibiotics and penicillin and things like that have perpetuated infections because they kill good bacteria that we have inside of us. And then these strains, just the strains of bacteria just evolved to resist the newest drug. And that also goes for flu shots. Can you explain about flu shots? I go into drugstores and they say, would you like a flu shot? And I said, no, I never take flu shots. They act like I'm a mass murderer.
And I have only taken one flu shot. And one of the advantages of being an independent is I don't get a corporation coming to me and will give you your flu shot. The problem is, as you say, evolution. So sorry, creationists, but things do evolve. And one of the things is that happens is that the bugs that survive the onslaught of the first medication are smart enough to evolve and pass on their evolutionary advantage to not get sick from that, not die from that. And on top of that, we have so many drugs given to factory farm animals. They have been so drugged up to keep them from being sick or to cure them after they've gotten sick that the animals have passed on the evolutionary advantage of outgrowing these drugs too, and we eat the animals, and then we have the evolutionary advantage as well. And the problem with flu shots, first of all, any type of they pick three particular strains of flu every year that they think are going to be the most prevalent. If they're wrong, and sometimes they have been, or if there's a slight variation, a mutation in that strain, the shot is no longer any good. So, you know, what can be done, you know, so those holistic methods are better. I know somebody over at KPFA who took a flu shot and got the flu. I don't think flu shots really are good, but you're told you're a mass murderer if you don't immunize your kids and you don't get flu shots because somebody might get sick, but it's really, there have got to be better ways. And on top of that, you're hearing about H7N9 and H1N1 and everything like that. They keep coming out with new flu shots. Excuse me, somebody's going to be passing right by here for a second. So they keep coming up with new strains of flu, they being Mother Nature, but they also being these scientists who want to find out what the terrorists might do, and so they keep inventing new strains of flu. And the flu shot people cannot always keep up with what's out there. So I think flu shots are a waste of time, too. I mean, I'm 58. I think I've taken one flu shot.
Well, didn't Donald Rumsfeld have a stock in Tamiflu or something like that?
I'm not sure, but I know that he was once the CEO of Searle.
Uh-huh.
Searle is one of those big pharmaceuticals. Tamiflu is turning out to be very bad. Japanese children are getting very bad side effects from it. You know, we're finding out that these pharmaceuticals, a lot of them that are made for one particular thing, are worse than the thing itself. Tamoxifen for breast cancer is turning out to be something that gives you ovarian cancer.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so this is why people need to do their own research. I'm not saying that all prescription drugs are bad or are useless, but you've got to be very careful about what you take it for, how long you take it, and if there are other avenues to pursue besides taking these drugs, because the science of the drugs right now is very reductionist. It's, we have this problem and we have this drug to solve this problem, but the body works in a way that is much more collaborative, and what is wrong and might be, this drug might be good for this thing that's wrong with you, but then it'll cause another reaction because another system is also involved, and that system will not get along with the drug. So we have got to stop this whole approach of looking at one thing and treating it in isolation. I think their pharmaceuticals would be better off doing that.
Right. There's so many things to talk about with Big Pharma and how we're being poisoned by our food with GMOs and, like you said, the antibiotics and steroids and all kinds of cocktail of drugs that the food animals get. But this is only like a 30-minute interview. And there's a whole thing about Ritalin and how our kids are being drugged for – basically just normal child behavior. And
yeah,
you know,
a lot of the people who are into protesting against the psychiatric industry are bringing up that, especially now that the latest DSM-5 was just published in San Francisco, they had their convention where they brought it out, and the people are being told basically that grief is after 2 weeks, if somebody you dies and you're still grieving, maybe you need an antidepressant. All of these issues of normal childhood behavior are now disorders that need to be treated. And it is the money. It is the money principle. It is the profit principle. These companies have their patents for certain drugs. They are now going out of patent, and to make more money, they have to make more drugs, and they have to keep more customers. And by having customers as children, it's very difficult to get off those psychiatric drugs. The kids are on it, and they end up on some sort of drug for life. But it's been found out now that a person who is on psychiatric drugs ends up with a 25-year shorter lifespan than the rest of us.
Jeez. Well,
yeah.
I recently wrote an article called The Peace Industrial Complex and the Failure of Movements, and you emailed me and you said that you had some anecdotes about that. So maybe in the last few minutes that we have, you can share some of your thoughts about that.
Well, the Peace Industrial Complex, you mentioned the organization MoveOn.org.
Right.
And at the time that they were clamoring for Bush's impeachment, MoveOn.org came out with they were going to favor the process of censure. Now, censure would not have removed Bush from office, whereas impeachment would have. So I was with Free Speech Radio News, which is allied to Pacifica, and I proposed a story whereby I would get a local professor of history or political science to explain the difference between censure and impeachment, and then I would ask someone from MoveOn.org why not impeachment, because that is the thing that gets Bush out of office. And then I was going to ask someone named Professor Francis Boyle, who's at the University of Illinois, who was himself launching an impeachment campaign, if MoveOn's tactics were going to be in his way. Well, the Free Speech Radio News sent one of the reporters who's local to me to basically talk me down to softening the article, and I didn't do that, and I just pulled it. And I found out later that they did not want to be seen as a lefty organization bashing another lefty organization. I find that this Peace Industrial Complex is more interested in protecting each other than they are in actually looking for peace or reporting on things that we really need for peace. And the wonderful, terrible example is 9/11. I did a lot of work on 9/11 that basically showed that 9/11 was an inside job. And I got people at KPFA and in Pacifica who were totally against it, not because they had found a counter story, but because I heard things like, well, it's not credible, and Amy Goodman will be hurt by this because people won't know the difference between Kelly's show and Amy's show, and they're looking out to protect themselves. And then I was, when Bonnie Faulkner and I got Guns and Butter into the regular program grid, we found that one woman who was on the program council, who was on our side, wanted to ask me some questions, which I did. I'd answer for her privately so that she would know what to say in the debate. And what she, her last question was, what about the Patriot Act? And I said, if you're worried about the Patriot Act, shut the doors. Stop taking the people's money and just, you know, quit. But that tells you that these so-called peace industrial groups are afraid of the government and are willing to just ally themselves with certain issues up to a certain point so that they don't get in trouble with the government.
Or they don't lose their, excuse me, foundation funding, which
yes.
is also allied with the government.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I almost sent to you a CD that unfortunately I've moved, so it's packed away, that shows that through the Ford Foundation, the CIA gave a lot of money to various groups in the arts, in media, et cetera, because they wanted to support a non-communist left. This goes back to the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And wanting to support a non-communist left that they could control that would make people think that they're really protesting something and that it's getting somewhere, and so they would not turn towards ideas of Marxism and socialism.
Doesn't Democracy Now! Get Ford Foundation funding?
Yes, yes. Democracy Now! Is one of the people on the list of that. You know, when the next time I go to the storage facility, I will get that CD out for you.
Well, I'm just having a small minor skirmish in the Bay Area with 350.org there.
Mm-hmm.
And they recently had a protest, and you know, they wouldn't let me have a few minutes to speak there. You know, even though my son was killed for oil, I just rode my bike across the country for these environmental issues. You know, when a Republican was president, I would have been welcomed with open arms when I was still identified as a Democrat. However, 350.org is like one of the leading so-called environmental groups out there, but they get funding from the Rockefellers. Rockefellers are Standard Oil, which are Chevron, and we were protesting at a Chevron refinery.
Yeah. That's
Hello?
Exactly. That's exactly the thing. People don't realize the funding that goes beyond this, which give me a minute to say that I am pro-demonetization, and I'm writing a book on that called Demonetization, Ending the Cult of Commodity, and I have a website called endingthecultbook.com, and I invite people to go there and partake of the discussion. I don't think the economy will ever be useful to us, and unless we move to gift economy principles and get rid of money and get rid of jobs as we know them and let people work as they will, we are going to be in deeper and deeper trouble. Charles Koch, the billionaire, has just said, oh, the poor would do better if we got rid of the minimum wage. You know, sorry, but in a money economy, the first thing about a job that has to be considered is that it pays. But these people manage to ruin all of our prospects. People are getting about 80% of people in the United States now will have experienced welfare or food stamps or unemployment for a large amount of time somewhere in their lives. The money job system is a failure. If what you want is for everybody to have their needs met and for everybody to have a place where they can work. We have to get rid of that entire system. And then that gets rid of the funding for these organizations, and they just would have to do what they do.
I think you're the one that gave me the info on Genevieve Vaughn that talked about a gift economy and had her on my show. So yes, very good. So Kelly Ramirez Watson, thanks for being on the show, and just give my listeners, and I will post links on my blog and on the newsletter for your book, but tell my listeners how they can buy your book, and please go to Kalia's page and purchase this booklet about eating poison, food, drugs, and health.
Right, Eating Poison, Food, Drugs, and Health is available at smashwords.com, www.smashwords.com for 99 cents. It's a 30 standard word page length book, almost 15,500 words. And if they go to smashwords.com and put the words Eating Poison into the search engine, it'll come right up. And there's lots of multiple formats. It doesn't matter whether you Nook or Kindle or Sony or Kobo or whatnot. There are formats for you.
Great, Kalia. Thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Thank you for having me.
Our next guest on the Soapbox today is author Mike Whitney. Mike lives in Washington State, and he's a contributing writer to Counterpunch. And we're going to be talking about his article this week in Counterpunch called Obama Puts, quote, Private Capital, end quote, at Center of Housing Plan.
Mike Whitney, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's nice to have you back on again. And I was telling you when we were chatting before the interview started that one good thing about having my own podcast is that I can see something like what we're going to talk about today and email you and ask you to be on the podcast so we can chat about it, because it interests me and I want to know more information. So thanks for taking the time to have this personal chat with thousands of other people.
And thank you for having me.
It's great. So I really we're in solidarity with so many things like Venezuela and the anti-war issue and things like that. So even though I might not talk to you all the time, I do read what you write and appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you, Cindy.
You're welcome.
Some of it's pretty dry and tedious stuff. I'm not quite sure how many people are out there actually going through it, but I appreciate that.
Well, I think you're a good writer. I really do. I think you make complicated things not so dry. But let's talk about your article. And most of the time, people can find you at Counterpunch, but I definitely will put a link to your article when we, when I send out the newsletter so people can read it themselves. But I contacted you to be on the show because I read an article that you wrote in Counterpunch called Obama Puts, quote, Private Capital, end quote, at Center of Housing Plan. Now, our friend in Venezuela, Hugo Chavez Presidente, said that, housing is a human right. And what the programs that they instituted in Venezuela were very, I don't know what the word is I'm searching for, but what they did was that they
built housing because they didn't have enough housing for people. Here in the United States, we have plenty of housing, but still millions of homeless people. So in Venezuela, they would build homes, they would put the people to work in the community building those homes. If there was land that the banks hadn't used or developed for a long time, Venezuela would pay the banks for that land. You know, it might not be, you know, exactly what the banks wanted, but this was a revolution, not, you know, not a paradise for capitalists. But, and then they would, the government would give no interest loans to the people, and they wouldn't even have to put a down payment. It was based on their ability to pay, not on capital's ability to make profit. So it seems to me that Obama's housing plan is almost the exact opposite of Venezuela. So can you tell us about your article and about what is going on now here in the United States?
Sure. And it is the exact opposite. But I'd like to say, first of all, that, you know, I'm not anti-free enterprise. I had my own business for 30 years. And so, and I don't see anything with people deriving a certain amount of profit from their hard-earned work. That doesn't. That's not. That's a lot different than putting private capital. And that, just to remind people, private capital is a term in the speech last Wednesday on housing that Obama used. You know, I mean, he didn't say privately owned banks or Wall Street or anything like that, which he probably should have. He said private capital. So he's basically elevating capitalism to this point where, you know, the organizing society around the profit-making abilities of a handful of very wealthy people is the way we're going to organize policy. So I think that's, you know, pretty central to what his message was in the speech. But what was kind of alarming about the speech is that, you know, a lot of people still feel like Obama's the socialist or Obama is the uber-liberal president. What he really said in the speech was that the private-owned banks and financial institutions, that they had their eye on Fannie and Freddie, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, these New Deal era inventions of FDR, to allow as many people as possible to afford homes that otherwise would have not been affordable. So working class people, and the amount of the home ownership rate would increase exponentially. He was going to reverse that whole process and put private capital in the driver's seat, and that meant that that fewer people are going to be able to get homes, and that these that private capital, who had been eyeballing the fact that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have been making enormous profits in the last couple of years, they feel like that's their next big pool of money that they want to go after. So what they want to happen is they want to strip Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, again, these enterprises that have put millions of working class people in homes through government-assisted low interest rates, and provide them with all the profit-making abilities of these institutions by offering them blanket government guarantees on the loans they issue. So in other words, if, you know, prior to the crisis, if these pools of loans that the banks had been selling, these subprime loans and these Alpha A's and all that kind of stuff, had a government guarantee, then they would have attracted even more investors. And the reason is because, you know, if you have a government guarantee on anything, people are going to buy it because they assume that investment vehicle is as safe as U.S. Treasuries, which it is, because the government has to pay you back if the investment defaults. So they want all the benefits from a government-run operation and all the profits, but none of the drawbacks. And this is where we get into basically the crux of the article, which is we're going to be, under Obama's plan, we're going to be providing these guarantees to the same sort of garbage loans and mortgages that the banks created before, and the losses, in Obama's speech, he says that, well, private capital is going to have to pay, no more bailouts. Well, that's not really the way that, if you look at the details, it's just such an incredible lie. I mean, if you even browse the details of the plan, these private bondholders that have these loans in these pools, these mortgage-backed securities, are going to pay a whopping 10%. 10%? Well, someone else has got to pick up the 90%. And Cindy, that's you and me and every other taxpayer in the United States. So,
when you were speaking, I just thought, this just sounds like a backdoor bailout to me.
Completely, completely. And, you know, no one else is writing about this. When I read today Dean Baker, he's the only guy I've seen out there that points to the fact that, you know, it's not, you know, private equity or private capital and the privately owned banks, they can lend money whenever they want. That's what they do. It's just, why should we guarantee that? That's what's different about this, is we're going to wind down these organizations that have been extremely useful in putting middle class, in growing the middle class and putting working class people into homes. And we're going to just eliminate them. And by their own admission, interest rates are going to go up. Well, why are interest rates going to go up? Well, because the banks can't lend money at the rate the Fed is lending it and expect to make money. So they have to raise rates. So how is it better for anyone? The only one it's better for is Wall Street. So it's really a mess.
In this so-called plan of Obama's, is there any guarantee for the consumers or the home buyer?
There is.
There is.
Yeah, and the guarantee is, remember Elizabeth Warren pushed and pushed for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, okay? And so now everyone is going, oh, man, this bureau is going to save us. This is the new watchdog agency, blah, blah, blah. But the banks fought, Wall Street fought tooth and nail to make sure that Elizabeth Warren wasn't the one running it, you know? Because the last thing you want is an honest person with integrity watching the, you know, guarding the hen house. So they got this guy, Richard Cordray, who by most people's admission is an honest guy, a well-meaning guy, but he doesn't have the strength or the character to stand up against Wall Street. And so they have what they're developing rules on what they call a qualified mortgage. Now, if the banks get under or maintain the standard under a qualified mortgage, then they are naturally approved for financing through Fannie and Freddie. And what that allows them to do is they're financing through Fannie and Freddie or through the government, and they are guaranteed that the government will not come back and say, hey, look, the guy you loan the money to isn't making his payments, so now you have to pay us back because he defaulted and you should have known that, okay? Do you understand that? Well, so, I mean, if I loan money to you and it meets the qualifications of this new agency, and then they come back and say, yeah, but Cindy doesn't have a job, she has no income, she has no collateral, and she has bad credit scores, you should have known that she couldn't pay. Well, the government approved it, so they can't ask for their money back. So the banks want to avoid any chance where they have to pay for the bad loans they create. That's basically what it's all about. So,
but do I get to keep my house?
Good question. No,
that's what I'm talking about. You know, the banks aren't going to lose anything. Wall Street's not going to lose anything. But the poor, person, by the way you described me, no job, bad credit, all that, no collateral, that's absolutely true.
You can include me in that, too.
Participating in this system to me is just like, it's always lose-lose for us and win-win for them.
Well, that's the way they've set it up, and that's what the new agency essentially does. I mean, the rules, just to point out, the rules for the new agency are this. They don't look at your credit scores, and a down payment is not required. So how do you, a bank would never make that sort of loan. So why would they expect, but their lawyers and lobbyists have fought tooth and nail to make sure that this new agency has these very lax, lenient standards that the banks would never use. So if the banks pass that test and get what they call a qualified mortgage, then they can turn these qualified mortgages into mortgage-backed securities and have blanket, basically, blanket government guarantees on those securities. Okay, and so, like, if those things in the next crash start falling apart and defaulting like crazy, it's going to all fall on the taxpayer. And why wouldn't it fall on the taxpayer? I mean, why wouldn't they do the same thing? They're not making their money by lending money to average people right now. So this whole scam is just going to duplicate itself in the future.
Well, yeah, and not only, like I said, does this like scream a backdoor bailout, this screams of another enormous bursting of a bubble and future economic ruin. And, you know, you said too in your article, and, you know, I told you before, I never heard of this speech. But I did hear of the speech Obama gave about the NSA, and I read an article that pointed out all the guy who wrote the article said that his speech was mendacious, which is just another word filled with lies. And you know, you point out in this article that you wrote for Counterpunch that Obama blamed Freddie and Fannie for the last economic, devastation that we had here in the United States. And you pointed out that that was completely a big lie, too.
You know, maybe I spent too much time on that in the article, but there's a reason why I did that. And I have three or four different quotes that provide pretty rock-solid evidence in really simple terms of why, the private lenders and private capital, as Obama likes to refer to them, the big banks on Wall Street, were entirely responsible. That the subprime loans that they created were defaulting at a rate of six times what they were from Fannie and Freddie, and that what they call the private label loans, those are the loans made by the individual banks, with such shoddy standards that anyone who could fog a mirror could get a $400,000 loan for some, you know, split level in Rancho Mirage or something like a Moraga. Anyway, so we all know what the story was, and we all know they were responsible. But since then, there's been a great, you know, revisionist history written by conservatives saying that the CRA, which is the Community Reinvestment Act, and other liberal government programs were responsible for the crash. Well, this is asinine. But, you know, I mean, various think tanks, conservative think tanks, have made this case, and it appears in all kinds of different media, trying to make the case that, you know, it was liberal do-goody government programs that were responsible. And so I spend a good portion of my article, this is what Barry Ritholtz, who writes for the Washington Times, or the Washington Post, calls the big lie. It's the big lie of the financial crisis that somehow government was responsible for it. Just forget that. It's nonsense. It's been totally disproven and discredited by every reputable economist and analyst out there, but they're still sticking with that same ridiculous story. So if you just read the quotes that I have in my article, even if you want to skip the article, you'll see that that's a completely nonsensical argument. And I just want to make that because you know how these lies and this propaganda gets a toehold and then people start believing it. So I spend a good portion of the article discrediting that. And then move on to the meat and potatoes, which is just this blanket government guarantees on loans and mortgage-backed securities that we know are going to blow up, that we know are going to lead to another bailout, that we know are going to be losses. For all of us. So But look who's pitching for it. I mean, I still have friends that are diehard Obama supporters. And I point this stuff out to them. Beyond the NSA, beyond the drone attacks, beyond Guantanamo, beyond all this stuff, you have this stuff, this factual data, and they're still, well, still better than Mitt Romney. I'm thinking, how? I mean, this is a disaster. I mean, this man is not only eviscerating our civil liberties and, you know, destroying our reputation around the world, killing people, but, I mean, he's handing over the whole hen house to the foxes. So, I don't know. You probably have
friends. He's been a very able servant of empire, hasn't he? And Wall Street, the banks, are just part of that. They finance the wars, and, you know, it's just like, oh gosh, it just seems to me like the end days of, Marie Antoinette, when they were like, let them eat cake, you know. It's like the wealth has become, to me, it appears, more and more concentrated in what, you know, Occupy Wall Street called the 1%. And it seems like Obama has done everything he can to help that. And it's just, like you said, you still have a lot of smart friends who support Obama.
Yeah.
And it's just because of this political partisan propaganda that we have to deal with all the time.
You know, I could understand their rationale when he was elected. And he said, well, you know, we need to look forward, not backward. And by that, he justified not pressing criminal charges against these people, okay? Maybe you could make some excuse for that, just like the country needs to heal or something, reconciliation. I don't know. But when you see a speech like this, where he is actively becoming an agent for Wall Street to press ahead this thing that you know is hurting the middle class, that you know is crushing ordinary working people and eliminating their chances of entering the middle class or of ever owning a home. How can you justify that? It's like shocking to me that people still support this man. There's no greater danger. It's shocking.
Well, I think part of the problem is even saying middle class, because, you know, I think since the Reagan years, at least that demographic has been shrinking. You know, now we're the working and poor class and then the upper class.
Yeah, and by every metric, you're right in that regard. Because, I mean, we know that in real terms, you know, people lost about 38, according to the Sentier Research papers, lost about 38% of their net wealth, average working class people, just from the time after the recession till today, that real wages, inflation-adjusted wages are shrinking now, that the only opportunities for work are these lower class or lower paying service entry, service sector jobs that, you know, don't pay more than $15 an hour. And that would never put you in a position where you could own a house, let alone rent, you know. I mean, which is why, what is it, like about 35% of what they call millennials are living at home now? I mean, it's just one disaster on top of the other, plus the gaping chasm of inequality that has expanded dramatically under Obama. So, I mean, he's been pretty good at finessing the whole thing, and his charismatic banter, which I can't stand. When I hear him on the radio, I just go straight for the knob. You know, I just can't stand it anymore. But it's more irritating than listening to Bush, because you just know he's snowballing you on everything.
Well, what's good, I think, is that people like you and the article I read about his NSA speech, they're really calling out the lies. And, you know, I read an article, you were talking about real wages and jobs and things like that. I read an article where Walmart is the largest employer in the United States, private, I guess, and a temp agency is the second.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I believe it, yes.
Yeah.
There's an article
How can we have a strong middle class when that's the truth? Oh, go ahead.
There's an article on the World Socialist website today. 95% of all the new jobs are temporary jobs. Well, you know, that's going to weaken demand, weaken the economy, but this is what they want. I mean, they call it a recovery. I would call it structural adjustment. What they're doing is they're intentionally keeping this grip on government spending so that we don't have growth more than 1.5%, which is what we have, which isn't enough to create more jobs, more demand. And that way we're crushing the organized labor and the entire working class section of America so that we're reduced to third world grinding poverty and competing nose to nose with the people in China and, you know, Taiwan, Vietnam, et cetera, which is, I think, the goal of this whole thing. But I guess that sounds too conspiratorial, but I don't see any evidence of them trying to revive the economy, and I study this stuff 24/7. So,
and that's what I was going to ask you. We're running out of time, but, you know, I know that you are not an expert because you say that yourself, but you do study it, and you, to me, your analysis is, well thought out. And instead of the speech Obama gave last week where he said he was going to put housing back in the hands or into the hands of private capital, what would you think would be a better solution?
Well, I think we should strengthen Fannie and Freddie. These, subprime loans, for example, and just to deviate a little bit, but, you know, you can lend, we've always loaned money successfully to people who have, like, bad credit or don't have completely stellar credit, and you can make those loans responsibly. Those people pay back. Just because someone didn't, was late on a bill at one time or had some trouble getting his salary so that he could pay off various debts that he had, doesn't mean that he's not a responsible person. The problem with the subprime loans is that the intention was just to make the loan to anyone so they could sell it to Wall Street. So it's not, I mean, we have to, these things are all targeted to improve the bottom line for Wall Street, and we just need reliable people in government who are not agents of Wall Street so that they'll do the people's work. I don't know what other solution there is besides that. Clearly Obama is not up to the task. And I think that with the NSA, the real thrust of that is not that, I mean, I know they're collecting information on all of us, but what they're really using it to affect is like spying on politicians and people in the courts and stuff like that so that they essentially blackmail, which is like what the was it Richard Tice, the guy, the former guy from the NSA said? He said that they were, he was on Democracy Now! A couple weeks ago, and he was saying he was actually collecting information on judges and politicians. So the real motive behind this is for this secret government that operates behind the guise of the politicians to control the politicians through blackmail. And, I mean, they got something on everyone. No one is completely clean. So I think that they can persuade these people to vote in their behalf. And unless we clean up that system, and that means getting the money out of the system, I don't have any secret solution beyond that.
Talk about the NSA. There's also, proof that they are data mining us to see where these hot spots of uprising are going to be. And they're going to move in very quickly to squelch that, you know. So they have, this metadata that where, oh, my gosh, we don't want a Tahrir Square to happen here in the United States. So they're like, actually analyzing that I don't know why I can't think of words today, but there's a great word I'm trying to think of to undermine it.
They're infiltrating. Is that it? They're infiltrating these groups.
They're trying to even, like, disperse movements before they start.
And they, you know, the FBI was very successful with Occupy, from my understanding, is that they infiltrated them very successfully and were able to identify the people who were going to be a problem. And I'm sure they've infiltrated the Tea Party as well on the right side of the aisle. I think that they see those people as a much, you know, organizers, and as a much greater threat than writers or something like that. You know, I mean, I just don't see that, you know, people who are doing what I am doing, because we're not organizing people, really pose any sort of viable threat. Although, you know, it's kind of interesting that guy Hastings, was it Michael Hastings, whose car disappeared in a, you know,
yes,
an explosion of flames. That story sounds extremely suspicious. So, you know,
oh, for sure. I just had a show on that a couple of weeks ago. Yeah.
So was he investigating Petraeus or what?
That's what the person, the investigative reporter I talked to, said.
Yeah. Well, you know, Petraeus didn't step down because of an affair. That's ridiculous. So someone has something on Petraeus. Right?
For sure. Yes, no. For sure.
So they know everything. But, you know, I keep looking at the weak link, you know, because I'm not sure political change is going to happen until we see something really shifting economically. And they're really in over their heads with this whole quantitative easing thing that they have to shut down because there's too many bubbles appearing in financial markets. And they're very concerned about what may happen in September and October when they start turning down the spigot and liquidity stops flowing to Wall Street. And, you know, you could see some major currency crisis develop around the world, and we could shift into, recession mode pretty quickly, because just as that has been beneficial for stocks, I don't know if you know it or not, but stock averages in the United States have gone up 140% in the last March 2009. Well, how do you get stock markets to rise that, you know, to more than double when the real economy is stuck in a long-term depression? So
right.
It's pretty – well, you just pump tons of money into financial markets, and voila, there you have your recovery.
Right.
So
right.
When you turn that into you turn that switch onto reverse, what happens? And that's what people are wondering, and we're going to find out in September. So buckle up.
It's always a bumpy ride. So,
yeah.
Mike Whitney, is there a way that people can contact you? And like I said, I will post the link to your article on Counterpunch when I send out my newsletter and when I post the show. So, but do you have an email where people can contact you if they have any questions? Or
Yes, it's at FergieWhitney@MSN.com. It's just at the bottom of the article. And
Oh, yes, it is.
You can send me your comments or your irate statement or whatever.
For support or questions.
Yeah,
sometimes that happens. Well,
yeah.
Mike Whitney, thanks so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox again, and it was great to talk to you.
Oh, thank you so much, Cindy, and it's an honor.
Okay, well, we'll keep in contact. Talk to you soon.
Bye now.
That's our soapbox for this week. I'm really proud of this show that puts these kinds of issues into the public discourse, because I know that there are so few people talking about these kinds of things and linking these issues together that need to be linked together. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar, and Community Progressive Radio. I'd like to thank my guests, Mike Whitney and Kalia Ramirez-Watson, for their work and for coming on the show and sharing that with us. And as always, I'd like to thank you for listening and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.